It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Milwaukee photographer took lots of pictures at Woodstock 50 years ago. Our guest tells us about the images that have been locked away for decades. First, that festival began 50 years ago today, and over the course of 4 days, more than 400,000 people showed up at a large dairy farm in New York State. The festival celebrated peace and love through music, art, and a fair amount of mind-altering substances. Woodstock organizers were overwhelmed by the turnout, and a lot of their original plans changed along the way. That means that some of the details of the event have been lost or unclear. But maybe the world of archaeology can help sort things out. Maria O'Donovan is a senior project director at the Public Archaeology Facility at Binghamton University. Her research focuses on urbanization and industrialization in the 19th century United States. She's been working on an archaeological project at the Woodstock site. Maria, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me. This is really a great opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Yeah, and I think for our listeners, they might hear archaeology and think of a Roman ruin or a Middle Eastern site or maybe Native Americans from thousands of years ago here in Wisconsin. What leads an archaeologist to do some research at Woodstock?
Right. Well, actually, what led us to do this particular research was a request from the Bethel Woods Center Museum at Bethel Woods, which is at the Woodstock site. They were getting ready for the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, which begins today, and thought archaeology could help them to interpret and to restore some of the Woodstock facilities. So that was what led us to do archaeology here.
50 years after, how do you get started as an archaeologist trying to figure out what you're tackling, what you're trying to find out on this site?
Well, basically, we thought about what methods would be good to use. So, for instance, in the Bindi Bazaar, which was the sort of trading center for the Woodstock concert in 1969, what we needed to find out, what our research goals were, was to locate the vendor booths or what was left of the vendor booths from the 1969 concert. In order to do that, we thought about what methods we could use and also what methods we could use to map them in because we were trying to record them so that Bethel Woods would have a permanent record of where they were.
And I understand you found that while the planners of Woodstock had a neat, orderly plan for how the bazaar would be shaped, that's not necessarily what happened in reality. What did you find?
Well, I mean, they did have plans. Maybe neat and orderly is going a little bit far, but they did have plans for where things would be located. What we found is the actual vendor booths where we actually were able to record them and where they're actually located in reality were not placed according to plan. They concentrated on one side of the hill and were not distributed the way that it was indicated on the sort of pre-planning plan for Woodstock.
I understand also that Woodstock has changed some. Plants grow, trees grow over the course of 50 years. What are some of the challenges in looking at what the site looks like today and backtracking 50 years?
Sure. Well, you know, the Bindi Bazaar area hasn't changed that much. It's still a wooded hillside. What has changed is that vegetation has grown up and you have to figure out how to deal with that and get rid of it. And to try to figure out how to deal with what vegetation is there in terms of finding things on the surface. The more massive changes had occurred in the main stage area, the main concert area, where there have been concerts after Woodstock, after the 69 Woodstock. There were other concerts in that area, and they had actually graded and filled some of this area. And that's actually pretty visible on the surface. You can see the indications. They're not right. The landscape is not right. It doesn't go in a natural formation.
What kind of level of detail do you have for people maybe visiting the site if they're hoping to see the spot where Jimi Hendrix played the national anthem, say, can we be that accurate and know, yeah, this is where that stage was?
Well, you know, you could be accurate enough for that, I think. Right now, the main concert area is in grass. And also has a few art installations on it. And you can pretty much tell where the basin where the main stage area was still.
What kind of things are going on there now, in part using your research to mark this site, to honor the history for visitors to the site?
Well, one of the things that happened this May was that Bethel Woods opened a segment of the trail system that they want to restore through the Bindi Bazaar. The Bindi Bazaar trail system went all through that hillside connecting, say, the main concert area and places like the Hog Farm through the Bindi Bazaar. So they're trying to restore this trail system, and Bethel Woods is trying to come up with an interpretive program for people walking along these trails. So they just opened a portion of that this May, early this May. And so our work helped facilitate that in that we came in, mapped the positions of the vendors booths, and gave them some more information on vendor booths for their interpretive program, and also more information on the potential location of the trails from 69.
Talking to Maria O'Donovan from Binghamton University. She's an archaeologist. We're talking about her work on the site of Woodstock, now on the 50th anniversary. Maria, I understand you work more, your day job is more focused on the 19th century. Does working on a site where we have more recent documents, maybe some oral history, and trying to figure it out here, does that give you insight on how to reconstruct the lives of people and activities of people a little further back?
We do have documents in the 19th century, and we always sort of compare, because archaeology is about material culture, we are always comparing the reality of what we find in the field materially with what people say they do. Because what people say they do and what people actually do are two very different things, generally, or often. And so that's the case, whether it's the 19th century or Roman times or 1969. So oral history does help a bit, but, you know, people don't necessarily have very accurate memories, particularly when they're involved in a concert experience that, say, involves some active use of substances.
Memory might be altered in some ways from the original reality, it sounds like, yeah.
Might be, yes, yeah.
Now, are there still mysteries or things you're hoping to figure out about the Woodstock site?
Well, I think there's certainly a lot of potential for research at the Woodstock site. You know, much of this will depend on what Bethel Woods has in mind in terms of their interpretive and preservation program, because right now they are the facility responsible for preserving the site. Woodstock was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 2017. So much of it depends on their plans. But things like the Hog Farm, other camping areas where people were actually living for those 3 days, certainly has a great deal of potential to sort of talk about other aspects of the site.
Are there other places that you think would be good candidates for this kind of contemporary archaeology treatment?
Sure. Archaeologists have actually, within the last couple of decades, started doing their work or researching contemporary contexts. And it's actually one of the main growth areas in archaeology today. Is contemporary archaeology, applying the methods and perspective of archaeology on material culture to contemporary sites. So places like trash dumps, shall we say immigration or refugee camps, things of that nature, tackling contemporary issues on the environment, trash, immigration, and migration issues. Yes, there's certainly a lot of potential.
Speaking of trash and coming back to Woodstock, I understand archaeologists love trash. It often leaves a lot of clues about what we do. What kind of material remains do you find, trash or treasure, or a little bit of both, I guess, at the Woodstock site?
Well, you know, in the Bindi Bazaar, we did not do any excavations. We didn't do anything subsurface. We did not dig. We were primarily looking for surface indications of the vendor booths. In the main concert area, we did do some excavations. We actually found it was fairly clean. A few things potentially could have been from 69, but, you know, trying to date something to 3 days is almost impossible.
guitar pick could have been from Woodstock. It could have been from one of those other concerts you mentioned.
Could have been from one of those other concerts. I mean, the area was continued to be used as open pasture after Woodstock. So, yes.
All right. And do you feel connected, maybe more connected to Woodstock and the music history there than you did before this project?
I believe so. I think our experience with Bethel Woods was very good. And, they're excellent people to work with and excellent people as stewards of this site. And I think they have a really strong message about how the aspects of the counterculture from the 1960s are still relevant today. And I think I've thought more about that since doing this research. Yes.
Maria, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Maria O'Donovan is Senior Project Director at the Public Archaeology Facility at Binghamton University and has been heading up a team that's doing archaeological research at the site of the Woodstock Music Festival in New York State. Thanks to a Wisconsin photographer, his family, and a New York artist, another visual perspective on Woodstock is coming back to life through hundreds of unpublished images. Nick Clementi is a designer and artist based in Sullivan County, New York, not far from the original site of the festival. When he was searching for the photographer of a particular Woodstock image, he found a lot more than he was expecting. Nick joins us from New York. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate the opportunity to share parts of this project. It's been quite inspiring.
Let's start where this story started for you. Talk about the Woodstock photograph that led you down this path.
Well, in September 2018, myself and another collaborative friend artist of mine, very focused on the music industry, named Mike Dubois, we said, well, here comes the 50th anniversary. Let's create some unique images and posters, and then we went off their ways. And one of the things that I had immediately thought of as a point of inspiration were some of the photos that I had seen various photographers take shots of the opening ceremony that was basically forgotten by a lot of people, but it really affected me in the early 70s. And that photo or photos were of Swami Satchidananda, very little known name at that time. And he did the opening invocation. So online, I found, to my surprise, a very high resolution shot of that opening ceremony taken by someone who was on the stage because it was in the back of the stage. And there's Swami Satchidananda, his back flanked by his entourage facing 400,000 or 500,000 people. And I looked at the photo online, kind of wondered why it was such high resolution without attribution. There was no credit to a photographer. So I took the bold move with, I'm going to use this photo, I'm going to create a poster, and I'm going to find the photographer. And if I don't find a photographer, I won't promote it, won't try to sell it or distribute it. Well, creating the image and the design, which is basically sourced around the powerful photo, but I did a little graphic play with it. And that was the easy and fun part. The difficult part was finding the author, finding the photographer. And I'm very familiar with the mechanisms and the processes of digging up information online, reverse image databases. I know photographers who were there, people who consider themselves aficionados in Woodstock memorabilia and facts. No one knew who this photographer was. They thought it was some of the other well-known photographers. It wasn't. And months went by, 2.5 months went by, and every now and then I'd chip away, no success. On December 6th, 2018, there was an article in a regional newspaper called the Poughkeepsie Journal, and it was another one of the many of explorations of, here comes Woodstock 50, what's going to happen? And there it was. The photograph, Swami Satchidananda, with attribution. It was embedded in the photo. I zoomed in. I see photo by Mark Goff.
Now, yeah, take us to Mark Goff. You ended up tracking the late, sadly, Mark Goff to Milwaukee.
And I found out that he had passed away.
Right.
On the spot, I Googled his name, passed away, and I waited after reading the obituary with kind of a moment of surprise and even mild shock. I just waited for about 6 weeks, and then I reached out to Mark's daughters, Leah and Allison. And they were remarkably open to the concept of me exploring what I can do with the material. All I knew was I was looking for one photo to have the rights of, and then in our conversations, as we were getting to know each other, they let me know that there was an entire file cabinet. And in that file cabinet, there were thousands of photos and hundreds from the Woodstock concert. And after creating a communication that was based on trust and mutual intention, they mailed me a box with the original film, the negatives,
wow,
including the 225 shots, 35 millimeter, mostly black and white, from the Woodstock concert.
Now,
I
talk about, tell us the kind of the photos you saw in that treasure trove.
Well, I have a lot of familiarity with traditional photography, history of photography also. And what I saw there, suddenly I made some immediate decisions, and that was to go to the next level of equipment in order to maximize the quality that these photos deserved in terms of scanning. There are scanners and there are scanners. I have scanners. I had two scanners. So I said, these photos are great on multiple levels. A, slice of history that haven't no one's seen. B, they were just good photographs from aesthetic perspectives, compositionally, and they were very powerful. A portraiture that has that unique quality of capturing the essence without imposing on the subject, etc. However, the photos weren't in great condition insofar as it wasn't stored with archival standards and protocol. They were stacked on top of each other. So it was kind of a delicate first step, but we were able to salvage all but maybe a half a dozen. And in addition to the Woodstock photos, Allison and Leah also sent me photos from his tenure in the U.S. Navy on the USS Kitty Hawk. They are outstanding photos. Also, sections of what only comes under the chapter of here's the lens on the counterculture, alternative media conference in 1970, a series of other musical venues from Summerfest and Midwest Pop Festival, fantastic photos, great composition, filled with energy, and most of them were in focus, and even the ones at Woodstock. And I always kind of joked with myself going, yeah, he just came out of Vietnam, so hanging out at Woodstock with all that, you know, chaos and energy was just another day in the life.
And that's the thing. He had all these put away in a file cabinet. It sounds like he didn't think he had anything particularly special there. He took the pictures.
I'm not sure about that. I think Mark Goff, never having met him, it's just I'm kind of living with his essence going.
Sure.
Work for the last 5 or 6 months, maybe 700 hours. But every conversation I have with Leah or with Allie or emails, we're constantly kind of go back, and then other people, his friends. So I'm gathering information, and maybe there's a little intuition. Maybe I'm sure. I have a picture that he was not necessarily a person who didn't think they were valuable, but he was not concerned about the promotion of, marketing of, sales of. No exhibits, no websites, and there's a number of possible reasons for that. There's not enough time here to go into all the minutiae to try to understand, you know, Mark's psychology and his motivations, but I do know that he was at the right place at the right time and did the right thing many times as a photojournalist, but then he sort of moved on. See, he was, you know, there's a difference between being a talented photojournalist or an artist or a musician and dancer and having the ambition to let other people know. So Mark was like, I'd rather ride my motorcycle than knock on doors and get a gallery and deal with all the, you know, the ups and downs and the kind of, you know, dances that us artists have to do to get promoted, right?
It's interesting, Nick. You're making this connection with Mark Goff, this Navy veteran, this photographer, through his work and through his photos.
That's right. And we are pretty much the same generation. I graduated from high school in 1969, and when I saw those photos, it was flashback with emotion and deja vu, even though I wasn't there particularly. So I can relate to them on certain levels.
Can you talk about a couple other images that struck you, maybe of famous people or maybe just the crowds?
Well, some of the crowd shots were extremely telling. They showed, you know, like the off the path, not even in front of the stage. Like you see gatherings of these people, and they're chanting, they're singing or they're chanting, and they're holding hands. And there's a painting in the background of some kind of Buddha and these structures. So there were these kind of waves of people looking for some sort of spiritual experience. They wanted to go beyond the this is part of the counterculture, part of what our society was reaching out at that time. He captured some of that. He also captured some of the simplest, like here's a vendor, you know, before we have, you know, typical craft shows and festivals with vendors and organized booths and all that. and Woodstock was part of the evolution of that, maybe even the catalyst that broke it through. So here comes, you know, someone making belts and jewelry, and they pull up with their 1968 Mustang and open the trunk and put their wares on a rug on the ground. He captured some of that stuff.
What happens now, Nick, with these images that you've taken such care to develop?
Well, these images are going to be more, what I said to Allie and Leah when we first started to get to know each other and realized we had some, you know, mutual intentions is, I don't know how many of these pieces are going to sell, who's going to buy them from it, but I do know that many people are going to know Mark Goff's name. And I believe that he has a chapter or subchapter in history of photojournalism. And between when I finished the first round, which was about a month ago, I basically used my experience as a photographer and a designer, and I chose out of the Woodstock portfolio 80 photos that I thought were superior in quality, definition, composition, etc. And so they are all now produced, scanned, photo retouched, and printed out in archival media. And as we speak, there's 5 exhibits in this region showcasing this work. And we're breaking the typical conventions of exhibition and showcasing art and photography, because typically you go to a gallery or someplace that's showcasing art, and they'll ask you before they say yes to showcasing, where has this stuff been shown before and when has it been shown? And under the intention of trying to maintain some exclusivity, people like to wait and all separate in space before they'll give another show. Well, in this case, 2 months ago, when I was knocking on doors and making phone calls, I said, this is not going to be gallery business as usual. I'm going to ask multiple venues if they want to show some of this stuff, and everyone who says yes is going to get some photos. And a little bit to my surprise, they all said yes.
Fantastic. Hopefully we'll see some of those coming to Wisconsin, too. Thanks to Nick Clementi, New York artist. We've been talking about photographer Mark Goff of Milwaukee and the images he captured of Woodstock starting 50 years ago today. Scam websites trying to take advantage of unsuspecting and vulnerable people tend to pop up after a variety of major events, from natural disasters to highly publicized data breaches. Now that people involved in the massive data breach of Equifax in 2017 are going through a settlement process, the Federal Trade Commission is warning people to be on the lookout for fake websites claiming to be part of that settlement. Tiffany Schultz is the Southwest Wisconsin Regional Director for the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. Tiffany, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, the FTC says, yeah, watch out. These sites are out there now, right?
They are. The BBB specifically has not seen one of them yet, but the FTC is warning about them. We understand they're out there, and the FTC has also reported on them.
And this seems like tailor-made for a scam, because this is a settlement. Lots of people are going to get $125 in this settlement, as I understand it, from Equifax. How do we know if the website we see or the email we get is legitimate, or it should raise red flags?
Well, Equifax is not sending emails. So if you get an email, completely a red flag. Go ahead and delete it. Equifax is planning on consumers going right to their sites to go ahead and file a claim. And you can do that at ftc.gov/Equifax. Equifax is spelled E-Q-U-I-F-A-X, or at EquifaxBreachSettlement.com. And it's extremely important to go ahead and type in those email or those website addresses. Don't Google it, because if you type it in wrong, scammers prey on wrong spelling. So you could possibly be going to an illegitimate website.
So going to somebody like the Federal Trade Commission at FTC.gov, that's usually going to be a good starting point, right? They're hopefully not in on the scams.
Right. And there would be a link right from the FTC.gov site as well. So if that's all you can remember, FTC.gov, and you can link to it from there as well.
And you mentioned the importance of spelling things out. And that sounds like a common red flag, something that might look legit on a website or especially in an email. But when you hover your mouse over it or you look closely at the link, it's not quite spelled right.
Right. And scammers prey on misspelling. So they could be spelling Equifax and just missing the U and the I. So they could spell E-Q-U. or EQIU instead of EQUI. So, you know, just be extremely careful about grammar and spelling to get you to the right site.
So these scam websites, what are they trying to get out of us?
They're trying to get personal information from you. So when you go ahead and you file that claim, they're looking to get your name, your social security number, any credit card information. They may be asking you to pay for credit monitoring or to file a claim. So definitely a scammer's goal to get any type of personal information that they can get from you.
And I think it was on the release from the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, they said some of these may be asking you to pay them money in order to get your settlement money. That's not how that works.
You should never have to pay money to get your settlement money. And be aware that the more people that file a claim, that $125 settlement may no longer be $125. They only have X amount of dollars to give you. So the more people that put a claim in for that $125, it could end up being half of it or pennies when all is said and done.
Okay. In general, what kind of scams do people seem to be falling for online, whether it's something like this Equifax or other popular scams out there?
We see all types of scams. Grandparent scam, you know, where they're trying to impersonate your grandchild. We see the imposter scam where they're posing as IRS agents. You know, you name it. There's scammers out there, and scammers will take advantage of any type of tragedy that's in the news. Charity scams are really popular right now as well. With September 11th approaching, you know, there might maybe some charity fundraisers out there. You know, we're many years past the event, but any type of scam, scammers follow the news, and they will capitalize on anything that they can capitalize on.
Talking to Tiffany Schultz from the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau, looking at online scams. The latest, this Equifax settlement, the FTC says, yeah, watch out. There are scam websites out there. Don't give them your money or your information. Go to FTC.gov to start seeing if you get some of that settlement money. Tiffany, what happens when people figure it out too late? They've already gone to that fake Equifax website or whatever the scam is. What are the next steps they should take if they think they've been ripped off?
They should report it to the FTC at FTC.gov. And we also have a phone number that they can call. It's 877-382-4357.
Okay. And are they out of luck? Is that just reporting it, or is there potentially some kind of recourse for them there?
At this point, I don't know where the FTC is going to take it, but that's a great starting point for any assistance if they feel that they have been scammed.
Here in Wisconsin, what kind of scams have you heard reported at the Better Business Bureau lately? What is on the loose here that we're watching out for?
Right now, with going back to school, we're seeing college rental scams. We want you to be aware of that, where there are housing scams and scammers advertise 1,400 square feet for $500 a month. It sounds too good to be true. If you're looking for a last minute property, you know, if your student is going off to college somewhere in another state, or if they're staying here, just really be on the lookout for any type of housing rental scam where it sounds too good to be true, because it probably is too good to be true.
Is there a solid way to check that kind of thing out to make sure this is a legit renter or landlord?
You always want to communicate with the landlord in person. So, you know, don't, you know, if he says, you know, I'm out of the area, you have to send me the money. That's a red flag right there. You want to definitely see the property in person to make sure it really exists. If you can't see it, send a friend or a family member to go take a look at it. And Google the address, too. Make sure that it's going to the property and it's not going to a field or a UPS store or some, you know, other location in the community. So lots of savvy steps that you can take to not be scammed.
And we've seen in the news reports of people getting calls from a government agency. I'm putting air quotes around that, the Social Security Division, something like that. And then a call from a county sheriff with a spoofed phone number. What kind of things are going on there?
Well, with the IRS scam, they will, Social Security scam, they will call you. And one of the things about that is the IRS will never communicate with you via phone. You will always receive communication in the mail by with them. So if you receive a phone call, go ahead and hang up because it's not true. And the police and the fire departments will never call you asking for money. Many of us have heard, you know, this is the Police and Fire Association. Will you give X amount of money as a donation? It's a scam. Hang up.
And in one case, someone who did unfortunately fall for the Social Security scam, they had asked to pay off the debt they owed in the form of Amazon gift cards. A government agency pretty much never going to do that, right?
That's a big trend with scams right now where they ask for gift cards because gift cards can't be traced. So if they're communicating with you via email, they ask you to scratch off the back of the gift cards. We've seen Amazon gift cards. We've seen Steam gift cards. We'd see iTunes gift cards. You email them those numbers on the back of the card and your money is gone immediately and it's not replaceable. So it's kind of taking the place of wiring money, but the wiring scams are still out there as well, asking people to wire them money.
And you mentioned fake charity scams. Of course, people want to give and be generous. What's your advice to people who do want to give to seek out the places that are legitimate?
Don't give immediately after a disaster. You always want to look for the official charity website. Make sure that you've done your research. If you're looking for through the GoFundMes, there's a lot of GoFundMe out there that seems legitimate, but either they are scammers or they don't have the infrastructure to get it to the right place. They're well-meaning sometimes, but they just don't have that infrastructure to get the funds to where they need to go. So look for that official charity site if you wish to donate.
And that might be a case to look for a group you've maybe heard of in the past, too.
Right.
In that situation.
And go through the specific charity. You know, look for those local ones in your area that can point you to the official page, too. There's usually some help there.
And what do you see from law enforcement when it comes to going after things like the Equifax settlement websites? Are there or other scams? Do we see a lot of law enforcement effort devoted to trying to stop these things?
There's law enforcement effort. There's BBB effort. There's FTC effort. There's a lot of effort that goes into this. And we have to remember that the scammers, you know, they always have a different variation of their scam. So once we all catch on, there may be a very similar scam, but it's a different variation of that scam. So then people haven't heard of that scam. So then it's just another process. But we are out there. We do a lot of investigations. The BBB has a full-time investigator on staff, and we do look into this stuff. So it's extremely important to report any scam that you hear about, and that can be done at bbb.org/scamtracker.
And one tactic I used to use that doesn't work anymore on my cell phone is, the cell phone number is blocked. That's probably not legit. Or why is this coming from another area code? Well, now they can make it look like it's coming from the local, area code and prefix.
Right. If you don't know where the number is coming from, don't answer it. Let it go to voicemail. Because one of the things that happens is if you answer that, they've achieved a working phone number. So if you start talking to them, you'll graduate yourself to another list and it'll just keep going. But if you hang up on them or you don't answer it, they don't have a working phone. They don't think they have a working phone number. So that's one way to shut down those robocalls as well.
Lots of fun stuff to watch out for. Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Tiffany Schultz, Southwest Wisconsin Regional Director for the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. We talked to her about how to look for and avoid scams, including websites related to settlements for the Equifax data breach. That's one of the latest out there, and other common kinds of swindles. Governor Tony Evers and other Democratic leaders introduced legislation today that would make universal background checks and other rules part of Wisconsin's gun laws. The move follows two deadly mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton earlier this month. Those shootings happened within 13 hours of each other. 31 people were killed. The move from Democrats will likely face opposition from Republicans in the state legislature. Laurel White is state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, for starters, Laurel, take us through what is in the Democrats' proposed legislation here.
So this is a proposal that's often referred to as universal background checks. So basically what this would do is it requires pretty much any gun sale in the state of Wisconsin to go through a federally licensed dealer and be subject to a background check at the time of sale. Now, there are a couple exceptions written into this law. Those include family inheritances or a gun that's given from one family member to another as a gift. And also guns that are classified as antiques by the federal government. So you wouldn't have to get the background check approval to do those things, but you would for a lot more instances in Wisconsin where there aren't background check requirements now.
Right. Let's talk about the current state of affairs for someone who owns a firearms store. It is a federal dealer. You would go through a background check in that situation. But there are some cases, as I understand it, with online purchases or gun show purchases where that background check doesn't happen currently. Is that right?
Absolutely. So just like you said, if you buy a gun online, you don't have to pass a background check. If you buy a gun at a gun show, which are, of course, very popular places to do that, you don't have to pass a background check. And this is something that Democratic lawmakers have been talking about for quite a while. They point to examples of instances in which individuals have used their guns improperly, have gotten those guns without passing a background check. One of those instances was highlighted actually this morning at this press conference where the governor and Democratic lawmakers rolled out this proposal. They had the police chief from the city of Middleton with them, and he oversaw the mass shooting that took place last year at a software company just outside of Madison. He said the shooter in that case was able to procure a gun that he used in that shooting without passing a background check. So that's the sort of thing that they point to. If we close what they call loopholes, if we close these loopholes, individuals that shouldn't have guns, it's going to be more difficult for them to get guns.
We've heard from some Republicans, it sounds like, their reactions to this proposal from Governor Evers and Democratic lawmakers today. What are we hearing so far?
So this is something that we've been asking Republican lawmakers for quite a while, obviously. We actually spoke to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald earlier this week when this proposal was still a little bit more of a possibility, you know, not a concrete bill that we had. And he said that he has concerns, as other Republican lawmakers do, with universal background checks because they believe them to be in violation of Second Amendment rights. So if this proposal were to pass, Senator Fitzgerald argues that individuals that buy their guns at a gun show or through an online sale would then have to register their firearm with the federal government. And individuals in the gun rights community have major concerns with that. They say that violates their rights. And Senator Fitzgerald just, you know, I believe his words were, my constituents are never going to go for that, and I don't support that. So I think that's a big, kind of big part of the narrative pushing back on that.
Have we heard legislative proposals from state Republicans in response to the recent, most recent mass shootings?
We haven't. That's something that I've worked on. I reached out to them. I believe that was just earlier this week. And they don't have any proposals as of right now to sort of offer in contrast to these Democratic proposals. So we have this universal background check proposal from Democrats. We have a so-called red flag law proposal from Democrats as well. What Republicans are sort of adding to the narrative as we talk about these things is that they want to continue to invest in things like mental health care in Wisconsin. They say that's a big part of the problem. They also want to have discussions. Senator Fitzgerald said this earlier this week when we were asking him about the universal background checks. He said, we need to look at more funding into security for these so-called soft targets, which are schools and buildings like the State Capitol building. And we know Republican lawmakers have made some of those investments in the past. They had a $100 million grant program last year for school security improvements. So that's something that's still being rolled out.
Talking to Laurel White, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, talking about a proposal from Governor Evers and Democrats in the legislature aimed at expanding background checks for firearm purchases in Wisconsin. Laurel, what do we know when it comes to public opinion? What do people in Wisconsin think about the idea of expanding background checks or closing loopholes, as some put it? What do we know about public opinion on that?
So that's another really common refrain from Democratic lawmakers as they roll out these proposals and continue to push these proposals. That is that universal background checks are incredibly popular with Wisconsin residents. We often point to the Marquette University Law School poll in the realms of politics in Wisconsin. They're a statewide poll that weighs, you know, different politicians' support and different issues. Last year, they asked about gun proposals. And according to that poll, about 80% of Wisconsinites support background checks for sales at gun shows. So Democrats are essentially arguing this is something that most people in Wisconsin want, and Republican lawmakers are standing in the way of that.
And Governor Evers and Democrats have been accusing the GOP of being, in effect, beholden to the NRA. Can you talk about how that talking point has come up for Democrats?
So that's something that Governor Evers mentioned again today. He said that GOP lawmakers essentially needed to stop waiting for permission from the NRA to move forward on some of these proposals. I think that's a big part of kind of the, you know, that talking point, that this is a popular thing that voters want, that their constituents want, but Republicans are unwilling to vote for it because of some of their supporters, including the NRA, that contribute to their campaigns, or some of their more vocal supporters that do have the concerns about Second Amendment rights being violated by these proposals. But Democrats argue that there aren't nearly as many of those people as Republicans claim.
The Democrats came forward with this idea, but the legislature isn't in session right now. Governor Evers, I understand, said he would consider calling a special session. Can you talk about when and how this could potentially come up for a discussion in the legislature?
So the governor did say again today that he's still considering calling that special session. We know that's something that Governor Walker did several times when he was in office. That's basically compelling lawmakers to come back to Madison when they're not regularly scheduled to do so, to take up something that the governor thinks is particularly important. As of right now, hasn't done that. He says he's still thinking about it. According to the current legislative schedule, lawmakers aren't expected to come back to Madison at the very earliest until the later part of next month. So late September, October is when they could take up some of these proposals if the governor doesn't go ahead and call that special session.
That said, if Republicans aren't on board with this, that would involve coming to a special session to, I guess, have this not voted on.
Right. I think what would happen in that case, if you had to guess, I think it would be Republicans would put forward some of the things that they think would respond to some of these mass shootings. So again, you know, they've talked about mental health funding. They've talked about increased security for schools and places like the state capitol. So if I had to hazard a guess, I think Republicans, if pressed to have a special session on guns, would put forward those proposals.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Laurel, is there any talk or evidence of negotiation between, say, the governor and Republican leadership on any of these items you just talked about?
Well, we know that the governor met with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss just yesterday, and we know that Speaker Voss, based on the comments from the governor this morning and the speaker himself this morning, that they're certainly not on the same page in terms of these universal background check proposals in particular. So we know they've been meeting, we know they've been talking, but they haven't been able to find common ground on this.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joins us today to talk about the bill proposed by Governor Tony Evers and state Democratic lawmakers that would make universal background checks part of the state's gun laws, with a couple exceptions, as we heard, for family transfers and certain firearms classified as antiques, and the uphill battle that legislation faces among Republican lawmakers. You can let us know what you think on the issue. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR on Twitter. You can always email ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you want to see happen. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we talked about zucchini, its abundance, and what to do with it in the kitchen. You shared a lot of your favorite ways to cook it, and since then, the ideas kept rolling in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here are some of your suggestions, your favorite zucchini recipes. Naomi says she likes her zucchini sautéed with onion and tomato, topped with cheddar cheese. Can't go wrong with putting cheese on stuff. Jim says drizzle it with olive oil, then top with Italian seasoning and Parmesan. Grill it until browned or slightly charred. I'll talk about grilling in just a minute. Barb says zucchini boats. I don't know if I didn't look this up. I don't know if this is like a food style or you just really let the zucchini grow big and then do like a dugout canoe out of zucchini. I don't know how what seaworthy that's going to be. Parker says zoodles, that's zucchini noodles, I think, and crisps, which are chips in England. So zoodles and crisps. Joel says, put it on your neighbor's front porch, ring the doorbell, then slip away unnoticed. Susie says, I give it to my mom, and she makes the best zucchini bread. And this sounds good. Heather says, you have it, scoop it out, season it, stuff it with a beef sausage mix, and bake it. Yum. And I did try, since last week's Food Friday, the post marinade. So you just sprinkle salt and olive oil on it, then you grill it, then you put in your vinegary, spicy marinade. And yeah, came out pretty good. Our guest from Bon Appetit had something to say. Tomorrow on Food Friday, it's chickpeas, aka garbanzo beans, with our own Lori Skelton. Get ready for some hummus. This is Central Time.